What's financial planning? What are we doing here this evening? And why am I a financial planner trying to encourage you to start thinking about your finances? Okay? Financial planning isn't something, unfortunately, that you would just do one time, that you just at one point in time you think about your finances. We all are constantly being reminded and associated with our finances and what's happening. There's no such thing as in our lives as not having financial elements to every single thing that we do most, whether it's making decisions about where we're going to live and how we're going to live and what we're going to buy in terms of shopping, in terms of food, in terms of transportation, in terms of jobs. Everything has a financial component to it. And so when we're thinking about financial planning, we're talking about a topic that really is something that has to be done ongoing, has to be thought about, and when you come to a new country, a new environment where things really are completely different than where we're used to, where you grew up, and many times we just absorb the way things work, like you're talking about the banking system. We understand how the banking system works in our home country, in our local branch, because we've been doing it for so many years. And you come to a foreign country, you come to, it's not only is it a foreign language, right, but it's a foreign culture, and then you have on top of that, you have a different financial system here, where we think it's the same financial system, it's just kind of transporting it from there to here. It's not. It's really a completely different financial system. The regulatory environment is different, and so we have to start thinking differently about our finances. Israel is a very different country than the United States. The standard of living here is much lower on a purely financial basis. Right? It's about anywhere from 50 to 60% of the average in the United States right now. Okay? But in many other ways, we all know the reason why we're here is because the standard of living on a spiritual level, on a quality of life level, on so many other elements, is higher, right? But we still have to make it here financially. And because things are so much tighter here, because salaries are lower, because expenses are not really cheaper, right? There's like a little slide in here, and if you want to take a look, I don't know if it doesn't come out so well. It's on the second page at the bottom, you'll see how much Israelis actually pay on average compared to all the other major industrial nations. And you see there, footwear, 18%, milk products and eggs, 44%, cars, we all know, you're paying 70% more here in Israel than you do for cars in many other places. Okay, so if expenses are not any less, and our income is in many situations lower, and in some cases not just a little bit lower, but a lot lower, so how do we make ends meet? So what we have to do is we have to start being much more conscious of our finances, and we have to be thinking and planning of where we want our money to go. We have to prioritize what's important in our lives and then translate that into a financial basis, right? So the most basic of decisions that people are making, right, something you mentioned, I'll touch on it briefly, is real estate. Where are we going to live? What are we going to afford? Most new Olim, when they're coming to Israel, they try to ease the transition by finding something similar to what they were actually used to living in Chutzlar. Many people will try, and many people overestimate how much they can actually afford initially. They'll move into a larger place or a cottage, you know, a house, right, like we knew in the old country, right, because that's what they were used to. That's what the kids are used to, ease the transition. And it many times doesn't work, and you end up having to downsize, because what we were used to over there doesn't necessarily translate into exactly over here. Right? And so we have to make those changes. We have to prioritize how much we can afford. And it'll translate into very practical decisions, like which community we can live in. Right? Do we live in Carmiel? Do we live in Ramat Beit Shemesh or in Yerushalayim or Tel Aviv? The standard of living, the price of real estate in this country is dramatically different depending on whether you're in the major centers or whether you're in the periphery. Right? And that everything has an implication. Everything has something that's going to come out of it depending on what's important to you. So financial planning really is prioritizing. It's for you to identify and to help you identify what's most important in your life and then to translate. Again, the car decision that you asked, right? So that'll become a decision. We're not going to be talking extensively about budgeting. I have other classes, again, that I can send you to if you're interested. But that's an example. When you're going through a budgeting exercise, determine where I should be spending my money. So you look at it and you say, okay, is this important? Is this more important than a slightly larger house, an extra room, sending kids to certain schools, having extracurricular activities, vacation, traveling back to the U.S., whatever it might be, everything ultimately, you know, when you're looking at it, at least on a month-to-month basis, is zero sum. In the long run, we can make a large effort to increase our income. We're not going to be focusing on that extensively here, but we can work very much on prioritizing what's important and what's less important, and that really can make all the difference, and it's especially critical here because things are so tight. Because we don't have the extra leeway. We don't have the extra larger income and that extra, you know, savings that we can be a little bit more loose with how we spend our money on a month-to-month basis. Okay? So that's what it is. It's a process. It's not an event. Okay? We want to be creating your own personalized roadmap. You want to create your plan of how you're going to make it here. And it's not just making it right now, it's also putting a plan in place of how you're going to be successful here for many, many, many decades. How are you going to retire here? Right? If you're younger and you're just starting off to save, so you have to be thinking about not just now, but also how you're going to successfully retire in Israel. There's also a life cycle process. Somebody in their 20s and their 30s is going to have very, very different financial decisions than somebody in their 40s and 50s and 60s, as well as somebody very different than somebody in their 70s and their 80s. Right? You have to be thinking through those different issues as you're getting older as well. And they change. Your insurance that was relevant for you when you were in your 20s and 30s having young children could be very different than what's important to you as you're approaching retirement. Right? Insurance is a great example, by the way, of an area that is completely different over here than it is over in the U.S. Okay? Almost pretty everyone here is really from the U.S., correct? Right. So there's no such thing as whole life insurance here in Israel. You cannot get insurance that's going to last your whole life. In Israel, everything is term. Term insurance will end at a certain period of time. Okay? And so you have to know what you need that insurance for and when it's going to end and when it's going to stop becoming so cost effective for you to have that insurance. Where does it fit into your financial plan? Okay? So that's the big picture. It's a process. It's something that you're going to have to start and something that people are going to have to revisit all the time. It doesn't mean you have to be sitting there every day. It doesn't mean you have to be, like, you know, going over, you know, for hours and hours on a weekly, monthly basis and worrying and planning. No, it's just something you have to be revisiting and coming back to. Okay, let's look at common mistake number one. Okay? One of the most common mistakes that I find is continuing to live your financial life in your former country even after Aliyah. Okay, it's a very common mistake. Now, it's not a mistake in the sense that I recommend that you completely sever all ties to the U.S. and have no bank account there. No, that's not what I mean. What I mean is that unfortunately the opposite takes place. People who come here and they live here, but everything to do with their finances stays abroad. Okay? They might have income coming from abroad, they might have bank accounts abroad, their insurance might be still being held there, they might do all their banking and all their credit cards, everything might be taking place in the U.S. And it can work in many ways, and for many people it's actually much easier because you get to continue to deal in English, you get to have these nice friendly service staff that you can call up and get answers to your questions and actually go online and be able to read the statements. There's a lot of ease of use in being able to continue to have your finances in the U.S. But there are other opportunities that you're missing out by not moving your finances here. Most people over time will start to transfer, to translate their life on a financial element to a proper, you know, Israeli system for many, many reasons, right? Most people just can't afford it. Most people might start off with an American job, but find themselves within a certain number of years having to understand what the system here is and what the employment benefits are and have to open up a bank account for just very practical reasons, like you might need to have access to your money on times when you might not be able to access it so easily. Right? Anybody who's been living here in the last couple of months has seen that people who were used to writing checks on their account and easily getting money to live on over here found themselves being having a very difficult time using the money changers to cash checks. Now, yes, there were lots of other ways to potentially get hold of your money, but it's not always going to be so simple, and it isn't always so simple. So transitioning to Israel has a lot of advantages. Okay? There are many issues, like currency issues, especially. Okay? When you're living in Israel, what are you spending? That's a simple answer right now. Most people can answer that. What are you spending? You're spending shekels.
Okay.
If you would have been in Israel 10 or 20 years ago, what would you have answered? What, sir? Euros? No, I wouldn't have said. I wouldn't have said lira. I would have said dollars, maybe, or I would have said partially shekels and partially dollars, because it depends on what I would buy. If I was buying an apartment in Israel, even 10 or 20 years ago, apartment prices were priced in dollars then. Rents were priced almost exclusively in dollars. Right? There was a thriving black market where if you wanted to buy a certain type of thing, you actually had to have dollars.
In Anglo communities or all over?
Throughout the country. Throughout the country. There are also lost opportunities. When you're not involved in the local economy, there are things that are happening here that you can lose out on. Okay, I'll give you an example. What's happened with real estate over the last 6 years? Right? Anybody who's come in the last 2 years knows that prices have become a lot more expensive. And when you might have been thinking about making Aliyah 5 years ago or 6 years ago, the real estate market was at a certain level. Real estate on average in the country has gone up 80% in the last 6 years. In many communities, it's gone up even higher. Okay? So it changes your reality. If you were to come here and you were to say, no, I'm going to keep my house over there and keep my money in dollars, I'm not going to have anything to do, then in theory you could have been here and living here and completely missed out on a real estate boom in the last 6 years. Okay? What would happen if all of a sudden inflation took off here in Israel because the economy started to take off? And in the United States, they went into a recession. So here, the interest rates would adjust. The bank deposits would start to pay out more. And over there, you might be dealing with deflation. It's a different reality. Okay? So you have to start thinking about moving your source and your primary financial activity to Israel. That doesn't mean I'm telling you have to move everything here tomorrow. It doesn't mean that you have to not have anything to do with the U.S. In many situations, there are good reasons why you want to keep connections, why you want to keep bank accounts, why you might even want to have insurance in the U.S. But you have to really think through the issues and see what's appropriate for you and what's not appropriate for you. Common mistake number two, a lack of financial goals. Okay? When you are earning a lot more money, and your expenses are reasonable, you can get away with not having a clear idea of what's important in your life. Here in Israel, as I mentioned, you have to have a clear idea. You have to be setting goals. You have to be thinking through what's important. Okay? You have to also just define for yourself what you view as being a successful Aliyah. If you're coming on Aliyah and you know that you're not going to be considered a success in your own eyes unless you have a large house and two cars and X, Y, and Z, so that's fine. However you want to define your success, that's great. But you still have to define it here in order to determine whether or not you can be successful here. Okay? That's not important to you. It's not important living in a big house. It's not important to have X, Y, and Z standard of living, so then that's fine. What is important to you? Define it. and define what are those things and then have a monetary component to it, whether it's education, whether it's travel, whether it's leisure, whatever it might be. Define what's important and define your measure of success here. And then you can start to integrate all those different financial pieces into how what you define as your success. Say there's both short-term goals and there's long-term, medium-term goals as well. Right? When you're first coming on Aliyah, you might be thinking in the first couple years, well, just how do I find a job? How do I get my bearing? How do I learn the financial system? How do I make ends meet for the first couple years? Right? So you might have a very short-term goal that says, I need to get through the next 2 years or the next year without spending too much of my savings. Right? You might have medium-term goals like retraining. Many people can continue to work in the profession, former profession. Many people find that they can't or that they can't afford to because the profession is too low paying, or they need new challenges, or they don't have the language, or they don't have the credentials, qualifications, whatever it might be, to succeed over here in the same field that they might have been working over there. So set yourself goals. Set yourself a plan in terms of how you're going to start integrating into that new reality. Okay? Housing, obviously, is a major issue. I recommend for most Olim that they should be renting initially because of the reasons, some of the reasons that you mentioned.
The rental fees.
The rental fees, it depends on how you look at them. Okay? But a major advantage to renting is that you can just get your feet wet and try to understand the local community and what works and what doesn't work without committing yourself to a very large purchase that may or may not work out. The costs of buying and selling and buying and selling are very expensive here. Right? Yeah, the real estate market has been going up, but what if you bought at a time the real estate wasn't going up and you have to find yourself, within a year or two having to not only pay all the taxes, but the real estate values were going down.
Does that ever happen in Israel?
Does it happen? So the last 6 years, as I mentioned, real estate's been going up.
Right.
From 2000 to 2007, overall, the real estate went down by 15% over that 6 to 7 year period of time. There are periods of time where real estate goes there. But it also depends on where you work. And if you were living in Beit Shemesh, for instance, the Beit Shemesh real estate has not gone down in the last probably 15 years. So it really depends on where you are. Okay? Aligning your lifestyle to your goals. All right? You have to really think very, very critically what's important to you and what's less important to you. How important is it that you have the car? That gives you extra flexibility. It gives you the ability to travel the country, etc. Is that important? Is it less important? How does it compare with all the other things that you have to be dealing with in your budget on a day-to-day basis? Okay, let's go on to mistake number three, lack of understanding the system. Okay, this is where I'm going to start getting into some of the very specifics of how the Israeli system works. Okay? Let me turn the page. Okay. Understanding the tax system. The tax system in Israel, right, is completely different than the American tax system. Okay? If you have an accountant here, you can ask all the questions you want about the American tax system.
Don't
ask
anything about Israeli.
Right. But in terms of Israel, right, you can't come here and just assume, well, it works like that over here. Now, Americans have a major disadvantage, right, that almost no other country on earth has. And that disadvantage is that you have to continue to file taxes in the U.S. Okay? And that is going to continue as long as you are a U.S. citizen, under almost all circumstances.
Our kids do something.
Your kids eventually will too. If they're American citizens. In fact, there are many, many American citizens worldwide who have never ever stepped on to the soil of the United States, whose parents might have been American, or they might have actually not, they not, might not even be American citizens, but they might have been born in the U.S. during a visit or something like that, they technically are American citizens and have an obligation to file taxes over there forever, as long as they're earning income.
Wow.
Okay? But that I'm not going to stress, I'm not going to focus on, obviously. Let's focus a little bit about on the Israeli system. Okay, in Israel, there's no universal reporting requirement. That means that you don't actually report your income to the tax authorities and file a tax return. Most people in the U.S. are filing tax returns. In Israel, it's not the case. It's only about 30 to 40% of Israeli citizens are filing tax returns. Okay? What does that mean then? Have, pardon me, 30 to 40%. What does that mean? That means that employers are remitting taxes for the average citizen here. It means you work for an employer. The employer takes taxes off at source based on how much you've earned, and they remit it for you.
And they remit the correct amount.
They are supposed to remit the correct amount.
Which in the U.S. they don't.
Well, again, but this, because the American tax system is much more complicated than the Israeli tax system, so everybody else at the end also has to file their own tax returns. Here in Israel, it's relatively simple if you're just earning income. There's fixed tax rates. There's fixed amounts of credits. Everybody can is eligible for a certain amount of credits that reduce your taxes payable. Everyone has a minimum amount, and it goes up depending on your personal circumstances. Everyone starts off with 2.25, if I'm not mistaken, credits, and then depending on your situation, depending on if you're male or female, if you have children, how old your children are, if you just did the army, if you live in a development town, if you're divorced, if you have a medical issue, if you're an Oleh Chadash, then you get extra additional credits which reduce your taxes. Okay, but it only reduces your taxes if you're earning money. Okay, if you're earning income, active income. It doesn't help you if you're only earning investment income, because that is taxed differently in this country. Okay? So if you were to come here to Israel and say, okay, well, I'm not going to work for the first 2 years or 3 years, I want to get my feet wet, etc., you would lose out on almost all of the tax benefit as an Oleh Chadash in the first couple years, because it's only relevant within the first 3.5 years that you're here. I'll give you an example. Most Israelis right now can earn up to about 5,000 shekels a month without paying any income tax here in Israel. Okay, it varies slightly depending on if you're male or female. If that's the starting place where you start to pay taxes after your initial 2 credits. But within the first 3 years, you actually have an additional 3 credits. Right, the first year, year and a half. Right? So those extra 3 credits are worth about another 500 shekels of tax savings a month. And in terms of income, that means you could actually earn up to 8 or 9,000 shekels a month without paying any taxes the first year. Okay?
First year.
Well, the first year, and then it goes down the year after that, and then it goes down after that.
Is it 5 or 8?
Starts off at 5 for the average person, okay, without any special credits. And then it goes up depending on your individual circumstance. You get extra credits as an Oleh Chadash. You get extra credits if you're female and you have children under the age of 18. You get extra credits if you're male and you have a child under the age of 3.
And if your employer is not reporting you, so they're just paying you, do you have to report that?
So you're asking like a general question in terms
of like...
So in Israel, if your employer is not issuing you a pay stub and officially reporting you, so then you have an obligation to become a self-employed worker, who then has a tik and atzmai, right? A tik, a file open at Matas Matzav, and then you report the income yourself. And Matas Matzav, much more complicated for self-employed workers here in Israel. Much more complicated. You have to deal with Matas Matzav as part of that 30 to 40%. Those are self-employed business owners and the like who actually have to have relations with Mas Hakhnasa, the tax authority. And it can be complicated, and it can be incredibly bureaucratic, and it's very problematic for Americans for other reasons also. Right? In Israel, you will actually have to pay Israeli Social Security, Bituach Lumi. And as a self-employed worker, you actually have to continue to pay in the U.S. Social Security on that.
Times two.
Times two. as a...
Self-employed. You're the employer and the employee.
Okay, yeah. So it comes out to being like an extra 16%, I believe, and then they have the medical tax, as opposed to if you're just a salaried employee here in Israel. A salaried employee has an exemption on income earned abroad, and so they don't pay Social Security, they don't have any taxes up to a certain amount of income earned. Okay? So it's important to understand the system. We're not going to be able to cover all the points related to the Israeli tax system. But what I really do want you to come out with is to understand that really things are very different here, and you do have to look into how it affects you individually. Okay, so we talked a little bit about salary income. How is investment income structured here? Just talk a little bit about investment income. Okay, the other major type of income that we have in this country is investment income. That includes interest, dividends, capital gains. Okay? Investment income in Israel is taxed from the very first shekel at a flat rate, whatever the rate is for that. Most investment income is taxed right now currently at 25%. And it's taxed no matter if you're making one shekel or if you're making a million shekels. The same rate. Where is it taxed? It's taxed at your bank or your brokerage house. Because again, you're not filing taxes if you're 70 or 60% of the country. So who's filing taxes for you? The bank is. The bank takes your gain after you received your gain, or before you actually received it, and they then pay the taxes on your behalf to the government, depending on how much taxes are due. Okay, and they're making certain assumptions as they go along, also how much taxes are actually due, and what happens if you actually have losses. So if you have losses, you have to be thinking about, well, how do I make sure that the losses are being applied against the gains? Because you're not filing taxes, and you're not having a carry forward loss. There aren't things like that here. So you do have to plan, you have to think through how taxes are going to impact on you. Now, I'm just going to ask, just make a note in terms of questions, because I'm just never going to get through the material. Okay? It's very important to also realize that because you're Americans, and because you have both reporting requirements in the U.S. and reporting requirements here, that you have to take into account two separate tax systems, which complicates your life tremendously, because some types of income might actually be defined one way in the U.S. and another way here in Israel. And under certain circumstances, if you don't properly plan, you can find yourself being double taxed. Okay, now that doesn't take place for most people and for most types of income, but it is important to know that, again, it's two separate systems. Okay, Olim Chadashim have a 10-year tax exemption on income that is earned outside of Israel, okay, during that 10-year period of time. That means if you are located outside of the country and you are earning that income, or if your assets are located outside of the country and they are earning that income for you, passive income, whether it's dividends, capital gains, interest, etc., right, royalties, that income is not going to be taxed in Israel for the first 10 years of after making Aliyah. Okay, it's a major tax advantage. Okay, but that doesn't mean you don't have to pay taxes in the U.S. You do have to pay taxes in the U.S. Okay, what does that not include? It does not include income that you're earning over here, even if your employer is over there outside of the country. So technically, Israel says, if I'm working here in Israel, even if I'm working for an American company, or even if I'm actually working right now for a hospital in the U.S., and I know, you know, radiologists who are sitting here reading x-rays for hospitals in the U.S., they're technically sitting here in Israel, that are obligated to pay Israeli taxes. Does everybody do it? I'm not talking about whether everybody does it or doesn't do it. Okay? But technically, that's how the exemption works. Okay? Donations. In Israel, you can reduce your taxes by 35% of all of the value of all donations that are made to recognized charities here in Israel. That's a major saving. 35% of your donation can be deducted from your taxes due. So if you made a 1,000 shekel donation, and you go through the process of trying to get your money back, your taxes deducted, right, reduced, so then you can get 350 shekels off your taxes for that 1,000 shekel donation. Save your donation receipt, and you can do it in one of two ways. We're right now approaching the end of the year, so you can do something that's called a te'um mas, which is going to Mas Hakmasa, bringing them your tloosh, your last pay stub, or the last couple, showing them that you have taxes that have been paid off, taken off, and you'll give them your tax receipt, and they will give you a letter to take to your employer, who will then take off less taxes, or actually might even give you back some of those taxes in your last paycheck. Okay? If you don't do that this month, so then you always have the option of filing a tax return. Tax returns in Israel come out, the forms come out in March or April, and usually do any time from May till the end of the year, depending on your accountant, depending on your system, depending on all these different things. Okay? What about Bituach Lumi? So Bituach Lumi is equivalent to Social Security Administration in the U.S., but even more extensive in the sense that it really deals with so much, right, that most people don't even know what your rights are. Okay? So the first thing you need to know is that there's a wonderful Bituach Lumi website that has got almost everything in English, okay? And you can go and get a very, very good background on all the benefits that are available through Bituach Lumi. Bituach Lumi not only pays pensions, they pay monthly income supplements, they have handicap disabilities, they pay unemployment, pensions, as I mentioned, income supplements, maternity leave, unemployment, etc. It is a wide range of potential benefits, but as applies to not only Bituach Lumi, you have to realize that when you're living in Israel, you also have to fight for your rights. Okay? Because you can go to one clerk, and that clerk can tell you, no, you don't. You can go to the next one right beside them, and then you can send in a letter, and you go and you talk to their manager, and it might take you 3 or 4 or 5 steps until you eventually get the answer that you want. But you have to realize that you're in the Middle East, and that's the reality there. Okay? Somebody asked about investing earlier, right? There are two main ways to invest here in Israel. You can invest through your bank or through the brokerage house. I'm talking about financial investments. I'm not talking about real estate. We talked a little bit about that earlier. Okay? If you invest through your bank, okay, there are two main fees that you're going to pay. One of them is called the Dmei Shmira, or the holding fee. It's like a custodial fee. The second is going to be a transaction fee for buying and selling. If you're buying mutual funds, which Americans should not be buying in Israel, okay, because mutual funds. They should not be buying mutual funds in Israel because it's very problematic for U.S. taxes to buy mutual funds in Israel. If you need more information about it, so check out my website. I have an article there about it. Okay, it was actually in Connections, I think, two months ago. So you don't have fees for buying mutual funds, but you do have transaction fees and you have a holding fee, okay, for holding your investments. Banks are only licensed to give advice. They can give you advice about how to invest, but they can't actually manage your money. The other investment option is through investment houses. The investment houses, in addition to also being a custodian for your assets, where you're also going to be paying those two fees, in addition, right, they can also manage your money. Okay? So when you have a portfolio manager, so the portfolio manager who works for one of the brokerage houses will be paid to actually manage your money, and they'll charge you a management fee in addition to those other two fees. Although many times it'll end up coming out still cheaper, because when you work with a manager, the manager has cheaper fees on those other things. So, full disclosure, so I am also a portfolio manager. I don't work for one of the large brokerage houses. I work for an independent brokerage house, or portfolio manager, and we, as independent portfolio managers, to manage your money, whether you want to have your money at the bank or whether you want to have your money at a brokerage house. Okay? And you pay a management fee for that separately and not related to whatever your custodian is charging you. But again, we have deals with the banks and with the brokerage houses, so you'll end up paying in many circumstances less for custodial fees and for transaction fees than you would be if you walk into a bank. Big banks.
Is it the same for retirement investments?
Okay, so hold off on that. We're going to get to retirement investment on the next slide. Okay?
Sorry, I'm wrong.
Portfolio managers have a different licensing than the investment advisors who work for the banks. Investment advisors can only give advice. Portfolio managers actually measure money. It's a different licensing. You get a limited power of attorney to be able to trade in your account, and then they actually are managing your account. Okay? As I mentioned, in terms of the taxation, everything here in Israel is taken off at source. Okay? That means you have taxes that are remitted for you, and then you take the report at the end of the year, and you use that for your American tax reporting. So there shouldn't be, under most circumstances, double taxation. I highly recommend people who are making Aliyah to consider bringing over some assets here to Israel. For some people, it makes sense to bring over everything. For other people, it might make sense to bring over a small amount and slowly build it up. But to have an exposure to the local market, to the local currency, is tremendously advantageous over the long run. The Israeli market has done really well, outperformed the U.S. market going back now decades. Okay? There are many, many up-and-coming Israeli companies that are traded locally. And even though until recently, like in the last couple months, the market here was going through a period of like kind of sideways actions for the last couple of years and wasn't performing as well as the American indexes have done in the last couple of years. But over the last decade or more, it's well outperformed the American markets. Right? They call the first decade of the century in the United States the lost decade because the markets were at the same level a decade in at the end of 2009 as they were at the beginning of 2000. In Israel, over that same period of time, the markets doubled. Okay? Safe saving. Israeli government bonds, not the ones that you would buy over there in the U.S., but the bonds that are traded on the Tel Aviv Stock Exchange, okay, have been one of the best safe investments around the world for going for decades. There are investment managers around the world who are bringing money to Israel to invest in Israeli government bonds that are traded on the exchanges. And they are a core part of every Israeli's retirement savings plan. And it's something that most people should be considering, how to integrate the Israeli exchanges into your portfolio needs. Okay? Let's talk a little bit about employment benefits. Check something. Okay. Employment benefits. Critical for employees here in Israel to understand what are the standard benefits that the average worker has, what they are entitled to, where the room is, because as I mentioned earlier, if you don't know, you're going to have an Israeli employer who's just going to pay you the minimum and only give you, you know, that, you know, what's the most basic of all rights that you have. Okay? There are many different types of benefits, many fringe benefits. I want to just focus on the two or three most important benefits that are really related to retirement and investment savings that are done through your employer. Okay, the first one, the retirement savings in Israel are all a percentage of your income earned. That means that if you come to Israel and you say, oh, I want to just deposit money into retirement savings plan, you can't do that. You have to actually earn income here, and you have to either have, if you're working with an employer, a matched contribution, but the employer is paying a certain amount and you are matching that, okay? Or if you're self-employed, you can also pay into a retirement savings plan as a self-employed worker, and that's my view. Generally, employers pay 5%. It's a maximum up to 7%, but generally it's 5, and it's matched by 5% by the employee. that 10 in total that gets put away into a retirement savings plan every month. That's of your gross salary. In addition to that, your employer by law has to contribute money towards your severance. Right? That is generally 8 1/3%. 8 1/3 times 12 would come out to being 100, which means that every year you have 1 month of your salary that is being put aside into your severance. So that gets you up to 18 1/3%. Okay? Then the other major benefit that many, many employees in this country have is called a Keren Hishtalmut, which is an advanced savings, an educational savings plan, right, that you contribute to for 6 years, and after the 6th year, then you can now have access to that money. Tax-free here in Israel. Talked a little bit about budgeting. I'm not going to go through. I really do hold that that prioritizing awareness, right, helps you tremendously make ends meet in this country. And people do need to budget here, even though, right, I ask this question all the time. Right, how many people here balance the checkbook when they were in the United States? Okay, the majority of people, almost everyone. And how many people balance the checkbook over here? Nobody. Why?
Because they don't send you the check.
Oh, so it's a good technical reason.
And they don't
reason.
Give you the register.
Okay.
The wallet.
You're right. It's all the bank's fault. we
all
have
kinds
to.
Weird things they do.
That's right. And it's hard, and it's complicated, and we don't understand. But you know what? It's basic financial management. Now, I'm not saying you have to do that. But why is it such that we come here and we kind of like meld into this culture where we don't really plan and everything, you have to stay there, right? It'll just like, it'll all work out. It doesn't all work out. I think just like, I want to go through another couple of critical tips, and then I'll stay around as long as people want to for asking questions, answering any questions. Okay, living within your budget. Some of these general tips. Okay, very, very important. I focus on it enough. Researching. Okay, in Israel, as I mentioned, because people will charge a gamut of prices, they'll charge whatever they think they can get, and then it'll go down, you really do have to do your research. We have a tremendous advantage from where people like a decade or 2 decades ago when the internet wasn't as prevalent and it wasn't as easy, and it wasn't as easy to bring things in also. You can do that now. You can research, you can get a lot of that information. It's especially important for large ticket items. To do that research, you can save a tremendous amount of money. I mentioned in terms of negotiating, right? There's a thriving used market for everything in this country, right? Furniture, appliances, etc. If you want to save money, something to consider. You can save a tremendous amount. The different lists, the Janglos, the Tangos, whatever bidding houses locally that you can bid on things, tremendous amounts of resources available, and you can save a lot of money, and it makes a difference, right? Right? Checking your bills, right? I mentioned in terms of making mistakes. I don't know why, but in Israel, the language is an issue that we don't check our bills and we don't understand. They make a lot of mistakes here. Let me just tell you. I've had experiences with the banks, people who have tried to actually charge you extra payments at the end of mortgages, and if you don't know how many payments you're supposed to be making and exactly what it's supposed to cost you, it can be costing you a tremendous amount. You have to check your credit card statement. Okay, there are charges all the time that you might not be able to identify. Okay, there's a statistic that I once read a while ago, or years ago, that there are in 1 out of every 10 credit card bills in the United States, there is a mistake. Hmm. Here in Israel, I guarantee you it's higher. Okay. It's everything. It's not just, the cell phone companies, the credit cards, the banks, etc. Part of it is you just have to understand what you've committed to and what you haven't committed to, and then work on trying to make sure that you're getting what they promised you. Okay? Planning ahead, again, is also very important. There's a lot of seasonality here. Things are more expensive or less expensive at certain periods of time. If you know something's coming, plan ahead, whether it's buying children's clothing or used books or it's like funny, even why is honey all of a sudden so much more expensive, the week before Rosh Hashanah? I don't know. But if you know these things are happening and you see it, you'll learn some of the tricks of the trade. Because if you've been here for a number of years, you'll notice that, like, you know, in that month before Rosh Hashanah, honey prices all of a sudden skyrocket. So then you plan ahead. Okay? You just have to look forward, look and anticipate things. Okay? What about some other quick tips? Okay, finding a guardian angel. Why? What do I call guardian angel? Guardian angel is somebody, anyone who's ahead of you in the process. It could be a local banker who you're friendly with, who speaks English. It could be that it's another Olé that you've worked with. It could be it's a professional. It could be somebody who can help you and start teaching you the ropes, who you can ask questions to, because if you're doing it like blind, you're going to make many, many, many more mistakes. And many times it's just a matter of reaching out to somebody, right? I suggest it very much with the banking system. Even though bankers generally will move branches every 5 years, it's still very worthwhile to go and to establish a relationship with somebody, because if you have a relationship, they can get you much better terms on many, many, many different elements. Okay? Invest in that relationship. Okay? It could be somebody at the Misrad HaKlita, the absorption ministry. It could be, it doesn't matter where, just if you make that connection, people are much more willing in this country to give out their phone numbers and have you contact them, and there's a much more family feeling, but you have to ask, you have to work at creating that relationship. Okay? In general, educating yourself. Sometimes we'll sign on the dotted line. Sometimes we will commit ourselves to things, especially in another language that we don't understand. It's a big purchase. If you're buying a home and a mortgage, understand things. Educate yourself. There's a tremendous amount of information online. There's people that you can speak with. Make that effort to educate yourself, and you'll find that you won't be frustrated a year or two or three later. Why all of a sudden were you, you know, had you committed yourself to a mortgage that's going up in value over time as opposed to going down in value? Right? I'm not joking. Right? Israeli mortgages for many, many, many years were structured almost exclusively. They were tsamud, they were connected to the inflation rate, and they were actually going up in value, the amount that you would owe. And so people would be paying a mortgage for 10 or 15 years and owe more than what they started.
Wow.
In general, I also highly recommend that you make Seder. You come and get organized in terms of your policies, in terms of your accounts. You're going to start managing your lives in two different continents, right, in different financial systems. It's going to get more complicated. You have different accounts. You have different policies. You might have multiple wills. You might have different policies that are dealing with the same thing. You might have insurance over there, insurance over here, disability, life, etc. Make a list. Keep track of it. Make sure that you have it. Make sure that your spouse has it. Make sure somebody else has that information. I know too many people, right, too many situations where people have lost tremendous amounts of assets because people just didn't even know where the money was.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If you're secretive and you don't share that information, you're potentially exposing your own family to unnecessary risk. Okay, the last thing I wanted to just cover, okay, has to do with an annual statement of worth. Okay, why is an annual statement of worth critical? What is an annual? It's just as simple as this. It's a point in time where you get a picture of what your savings are, what your liabilities are, what you're worth in a certain sense on a financial basis. And why is that so important? And why is it so important when you're making Aliyah? Okay? Because many times when we make Aliyah, there's a tremendous amount of money that just kind of flows through our hands. And we don't even realize it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Anybody who's here within their first year knows just how much money, the settlement, et cetera, et cetera. And where is it going? And what did I have in the bank originally? And how much did I plan? If you have a plan in place, and you know what you thought you wanted to spend, what you think you could afford, right? And you track it over time, you'll be able to determine, are you on track or you're not on track? Okay? So you literally just make a list. Here's an example. Again, this is like an example here. I'll pass this around. It's just a statement. It's got by year, it's got all the different assets and your liabilities. But you can get an idea of where you're holding. And that's why I have those charts over here. Because, right? You see that first chart? That first chart has you at time X, over here, let's say that's like 5 years in, and you've saved 1 million shekels. So how has he done it? How are you doing at that point in time if you've saved 1 million shekels? We have no idea.
Oh.
We have no idea. Did you start over here at the top of that line on the next diagram, and now you've only had 1 million shekels, but you started and you came to Israel with 5 million shekels, and you're now, you know, 28, and you have to, like, make that money last, right? Or are you saving money? Right? What about that little squiggly line that you see there? Right? The person's saving, and now all of a sudden, now it starts to go down. Are they doing okay? Are they not doing okay? Well, it depends. Did they go down? Are they contracting because they lost their job for a certain period of time, and now they have a job? Or are they at an age where they now can't find a job, and now they have to start living off of those savings all the way through retirement? A statement of net worth will give you a perspective. Are you reaching your goals? Are you on track? Right? If you track it, if you see where you are, you'll be able to evaluate. Am I accomplishing what I set out? Am I spending more? Too many people have no idea how much money is being spent in the first year, especially. And therefore, they have no idea. So for something like this, you would actually do more often. You wouldn't just do once a year. You would actually track it over time to get an idea. Are you spending too much? Do you need to cut down? Do you need to find a job earlier? Some people, in terms of their 5-year or 2-year plan, might say, well, I need to find a job within X amount of time. But then they might realize after they've lived here for 6 months that they've spent much more money than they ever expected, and they actually have to start working much sooner. But you won't know that if you're not tracking. You won't know that if you have no idea of where your money is going. Right? When people come and they sit with me in the office, one of the first questions I always ask people is I say, right, how much money are you spending on a monthly basis? Because you have to know that. You have to know that because it affects everything in your plan. Do you need to be earning more money? Should you be saving more right now? You have to be building up. Right? Are you at a point in time in your life that you can start spending down? How much can you afford? Those are all questions that are dependent on what your standard of living is. And you wouldn't believe how many people have no idea what they're spending. And it's very chaotic in the first year, especially, because there's so many things, and this isn't a regular expense, and this isn't a regular expense, and so what am I spending? And you have no idea, but you have to know. You have to track it. You have to get some kind of an idea, because it'll help you make practical decisions. Okay? And that's really what the essence of financial planning is, helping you to make practical decisions about what's important and what's less important for you.